This TED Talk is from author and host of the After On podcast, Rob Reed. He actually first gave it at TED 2019, but he made a lot of visual references on stage, which doesn't really translate well in audio. So we asked Rob to come into our studio and re-deliver his talk just for TED Talks Daily. We'd love to know what you think. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or send us an email at podcasts@TED.com.
There's about 7.5 billion people on Earth. The World Health Organization says that 300 million of us are depressed, and that about 800,000 people take their lives every year. A tiny subset of them choose a profoundly nihilistic route, which is they die in the act of murdering as many people as possible. One of them recently killed 58 people in Las Vegas, as you probably know. Another murdered 49 people in Orlando. You may not have heard of the guy who killed 5 people in the town of Aurora, Illinois, in February. Not because it wasn't a tragedy, because, of course, it was, but because there's so much of this going on. Just last year, Wikipedia counted 323 mass shootings in the United States alone. Not all those shooters were suicidal, and not all were maximizing their death tolls, but many, many were. An important question becomes, what limits do these people have? Take the Vegas shooter. He slaughtered 58 people. Did he stop there because he'd had enough? No. And we know this because he shot and injured another 422 people who he surely would have preferred to kill. And we have no reason to think he'd have stopped at 4,022 victims. In fact, someone that nihilistic might have gladly killed us all. We don't know. What we do know is this. When suicidal mass murderers really go all in, technology is the force multiplier. Here's an example. Several years back, there was a rash of 10 mass school attacks in China, carried out with things like knives and hammers and cleavers, because guns are really hard to get there. By macabre coincidence, the last of those attacks occurred just hours before the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. But that one American attack killed roughly the same number of victims as the 10 Chinese attacks combined. So we can fairly say, knife, terrible. Gun, way worse. And airplane, massively worse, as pilot Andreas Lubitz showed when he forced 149 people to join him in his suicide, smashing a plane into the French Alps. Just about a year after a Malaysia Airlines pilot did something similar to his passengers and crew. And I'm afraid there are far more deadly weapons in our near future than airplanes, ones not made of metal. So let's consider the apocalyptic dynamics that will ensue if suicidal mass murder hitches a ride on a rapidly advancing field which, for the most part, holds boundless promise for society. Somewhere out in the world, there's a tiny group of people who would attempt, however ineptly, to kill us all if they could just figure out how. The Vegas shooter may or may not have been in this group, but with 7.5 billion of us, at least a handful of people are in this deeply disturbed category. There's plenty of suicidal nihilists out there. We've already seen that. There are also people with severe mood disorders. People have just suffered deranging traumas and bitter sociopaths at the end of their days who resent the thought of life going on without them, etc. As for the people who could actually kill us all, or at least come close, they simply numbered zero, forever, until the Cold War, when suddenly the heads of two global alliances attained the ability to blow up the planet. Since then, the number of people with actual doomsday buttons has stayed close to two-ish, but I'm afraid it's about to grow, and not just to three-ish, but off the charts, as in way into double digits. And if we survive that, much further still. The reason is we live in the age of exponential technologies, which routinely take eternal impossibilities and make them the actual superpowers of one or two living geniuses. And then, this is the key part, diffuse those powers to more or less everybody. Here's a benign example. In 1952, literally one man on Earth, his name was Arthur Samuel, had the skills and resources necessary to play checkers against a computer. He was a programming genius with full access to one of the world's most powerful computers, and he taught it to play. That's what it used to take to play digital checkers. Today, you just need to know someone who knows someone who owns a telephone. Because computing is an exponential technology. So is synthetic biology, which I'll now refer to as SynBio. And in 2011, a couple of SynBio researchers performed something every bit as ingenious and unprecedented as that long-ago checkers breakthrough on something called H5N1 flu. This is a strain that kills up to 60% of the people it infects, more than Ebola. But it's so uncontagious that it's killed fewer than 50 people since 2015. So these researchers edited H5N1's genome and made it every bit as deadly, but also wildly contagious. Dare to have it all, right? The news arm of Science, which is one of the world's top two scientific journals, said if this thing got out, it would likely cause a pandemic with perhaps millions of deaths. Meanwhile, the chair of the U.S. Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, Dr. Paul Keim, said he couldn't think of an organism as scary as this one. He added that anthrax isn't scary at all compared to it, which is not reassuring, given that Dr. Keim is also a world-class anthrax expert. Now, the good news is the people behind this biohack meant us no harm. They're virologists and believe that they were advancing science. The bad news is that technology doesn't freeze in place. And over the next few decades, this sort of entry-level flu hacking will become trivially easy. In fact, it's already way easier, because just 2 years after those researchers did their work, the CRISPR system was harnessed for genome editing. This was a radical breakthrough that makes gene editing massively easier. So easy that CRISPR's now taught in high schools. And this stuff is advancing even faster than computing did. The cost of reading a full human genome has dropped massively over the past decade and a half. The closely related technologies of genetic editing and synthesis are also moving forward at similarly headlong rates. And the keys to the kingdom are tiny, tiny data files. The entire H5N1 genome fits on just a few pages. It's freely available online, and the tiny edits which make it contagious, they might fit on a single post-it note. And once a genius creates a data file, any idiot can copy it, distribute it worldwide, or print it. And I don't just mean print it on paper, but soon enough, on actual DNA. So let's conjure a little ghost story. Let's say it's 2026, to pick an arbitrary year, and a brilliant virologist hoping to advance science and better understand pandemics designs a new bug. It's as contagious as chickenpox, it's as deadly as Ebola, and it incubates for months and months before causing an outbreak. This means the whole world could be infected before the first sign of trouble. Next, not long after our researcher completes this project, her university gets hacked. And of course, this part of our story is not science fiction. Indeed, the hacking of over 300 universities is documented in just one recent U.S. indictment. And so the file containing the bug's genome spreads to the internet's darkest corners. And once the file's out there, it never comes back. Just ask any movie studio or music label. Now, maybe in the year 2026, it will still take a true genius, like our virologist, to make the actual living critter. But 15 years after that, maybe it'll just take a DNA printer, one you can find at any high school. And if not, just wait a couple of decades. Now, remember that small group of people who'd try to kill us all if they could just figure out how? If we end up empowering them, and one of them takes a crack at this and blows it almost completely, it could still be the most deadly act in human history. Because an attack that's just 0.1% effective would kill almost 8 million people. That's 2,500 9/11s. Civilization would survive, but it would be permanently disfigured. So when it comes to doomsday bugs, we'll need to worry about anyone with the faintest shot on goal at creating one. For now, that's probably just a handful of geniuses. But think about that. A tiny handful of truly brilliant folks probably could already make a doomsday bug that's at least 0.1% effective. Now, these people tend to be stable and successful and to lack violent histories. So I guess I'm sorta, kinda, barely okay-ish with that. But what about after technology improves and diffuses, and thousands of life science researchers are enabled to do something wicked and entrepreneurial with deadly pathogens? Are every single one of them going to be perfectly stable? Or how about a few years after that, when every stress-ridden pre-med and bioengineering grad student is enabled, At that point, we'll be talking about hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world. And when a group gets that big, at least a handful of its members will reliably do something awful and unexpected at some point. Because no population, however elite or well-connected, is immune to psychotic breaks, to life-deranging traumas, or to merely harboring evil. You may recall the guy who dressed up like the Joker and shot 12 people to death at a Batman premiere. That was a neuroscience PhD student with an NIH grant pulling the trigger. Okay, plot twist. I am a hardcore optimist, one who believes we can survive these dynamics if we start focusing on them now. And I say this having spent countless hours interviewing global leaders in SynBio, and also researching their work for a science podcast I create. I have come to fear SynBio's worst-case potential, in case I haven't made that entirely clear yet. But more than that, to revere its promise. Over time, this stuff will cure cancer, heal our environment, and stop our cruel treatment of other creatures. So how do we get all that without, you know, annihilating ourselves? The first thing is to accept that SynBio is here, whether we like it or not. So let's like it and embrace the field. Banning it would only hand the wheel to bad actors. Because unlike nuclear programs, biology can be practiced invisibly. Massive Soviet cheating on bioweapons treaties during the Cold War made this very clear, as do the world's countless illegal drug labs. Second, we need to enlist the experts. In fact, we ought to make more of them. Because out of every million and one bioengineers, at least a million are gonna be on our side. I mean, Al Capone would be on our side. The bar to being a good guy here is just so low. And even when a single bad guy can inflict grievous harm, a massive numerical advantage can matter, especially when time is on our side. As for now, at least, it is. We have years and hopefully decades to prepare and prevent. The first person to try something awful, and there will be somebody, may not even be born yet. But this effort needs to go far beyond specialists and span society. Because the trick is, we need to both contain and exploit synthetic biology. Contain its dangers, obviously, but also exploit its incredible potential to radically improve and even lengthen lives throughout the world. This inevitably means commercialization and private market incentives. But we cannot ask an inner clique of experts to both contain and exploit something. We tried that with the financial system. And that thoroughly corrupted our stewards, who learned to cut corners, inflict extreme risks on the rest of us, and privatize the gains until they grew repulsively wealthy and stuck us with the $22 trillion bill. After that, online privacy started looming as a huge and complex issue, an issue we basically outsourced and entrusted to companies like Facebook, which proceeded to sell, leak, and expose our most private personal data. So once again, privatize gains, socialize losses. This pattern is getting old. So we clearly need a more inclusive way to safeguard our prosperity, our privacy, and soon, our lives. So how do we pull this off? Well, when bodies fight pathogens, they use ingenious immune systems, which are agile, self-training, and multi-layered. Why don't we build one of those for the whole damn biosphere? That immune system's base layer would be defensive technology. Years of TED Talks could be given on this topic alone, so I'll briefly describe just two of many great ideas that are out there. First, some R&D muscle could put today's primitive pathogen sensors, or germ detectors, on a very steep price-performance curve. They'd become increasingly ingenious and networked, then one day, as widespread as smoke detectors, or better yet, smartphones. On a very related note, vaccines have massive manufacturing and distribution challenges, and once they're made, they can't adapt to new threats or mutations. We need an agile biomanufacturing base extending into every single pharmacy, and maybe even our homes. Printer technology for vaccines and medicines is within reach if we prioritize it. Next, mental health. People who commit suicidal mass murder often suffer from crippling treatment-resistant depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. We need noble researchers working on this, but we also need the selfish jerks, who are way more numerous, to to realize that acute suffering could soon endanger all of us, not just those afflicted. Those jerks will then join us and Al Capone in fighting this condition. Third, each and every one of us can be and should be a white blood cell in this immune system, to quote my friend Naval Ravikant. Suicidal mass murderers can be despicable, yes, but they're also desperately sad and broken people. Those of us who are not should do what we can to make sure nobody goes unloved. Next, we need to make fighting these dangers core to the discipline of synthetic biology. Some companies at least claim to give employees 20% of their time to work on whatever they want. What if those who hire and become bioengineers give 20% of their time to working on defenses for the common good? Finally, it will be no fun. But we need to let our minds go to some very, very dark places. And thank you for letting me take you there today. We survived the Cold War because every one of us understood and respected the danger. In part because we'd spent decades telling ourselves terrifying ghost stories with names like Dr. Strangelove and War Games. So please, do not remain calm. This is a rare time when it's incredibly productive to freak the hell out, to conjure some ghost stories, and to turn our fear into fuel to fight this danger. Because the awful scenarios here, they're not destiny. They're optional. And the danger is still kind of distant. That means it will only befall us if we allow it to. Let's not.
For more TED Talks, go to TED.com.